Welcome to Connoisseurs, our regular conversation by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Lee Lee, a media professional.
Don Eubanks, assistant professor at Metropolitan State University.
Luz Maria Frias, an attorney with a public policy background and also president and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis.
And Tom Weber from NPR News and our friend Anthony Galloway. We're actually recording this on Monday, and Anthony's one of the many people who went
to go watch the eclipse.
Yes. Which was very cool, even here in Minnesota. So we'll see you next time, Anthony. Yes. I hope you had a great trip.
So, I mean, there's a lot to talk about. I think the first thing that popped into our minds when we all walked in here was the events that had happened in Charlottesville. I guess I would just, I think we could talk a little bit about how we here in Minnesota can maybe make a difference or do something. I know from my Facebook feed, as I'm sure you guys, there's been a lot of discussion. There's been a lot of really, really worried people. At the same time, there's been a lot of criticism about the way people are reacting. For example, the Tina Fey bit had a big reaction.
The sheet cake bit.
And so how are we coping with this right now?
You know, and a lot of debate and discussion after Charlottesville and taking President Trump's comments, you know, if we remove, in his mind, we're removing part of their history with, because this whole thing was about just taking down Robert E. Lee's statue, mm-hmm. even though that kind of got fell to the wayside as mm-hmm. their, I mean, you know, because what they did on the University of Virginia campus with those tiki torches was very symbolic of Nazism.
Or a Ku Klux Klan gathering when they're burning the crosses.
It's only going to get worse. The Ku Klux Klan is going to make a big comeback because social media has been, quote unquote, outing these people who have been these marchers who have come on and said, well, I'm not really a racist. That's going to bring back the capes and stuff.
That's been really interesting just to unpack that a little bit. Halee, what you're referring to is the photos that went viral of the white nationalists who were protesting and engaging in these violent acts in Charlottesville, that there was actually an organized effort / campaign to identify each one of those and then contact their employers mm-hmm. to get them fired. And from what I saw and read, that was pretty successful.
Yes, it worked. And that made a lot of people angry. And then there was, you know, made a couple of guys who were featured in some really, really great photos come out and say, I'm not really a racist.
So why do you think that, I mean, I think Luz's point was that for her impression, that was a good aspect of
that
what happened with social media. You use the
crowdsourcing,
you identify these people.
Right.
But your point was, no, actually, I think this means that
they're just going to start wearing capes and masks and stuff.
So you think they're going to go underground?
Under hood.
I mean, the only ones who went under hood were KKK.
Right.
Now, the rest of them just weren't visible enough for us to identify
right.
them.
Do you really think, though, after what we saw in Boston, for example, where the counter-protesters outnumbered the actual white supremacists 40,000 to 100, do you really
right.
think that if a group of people actually showed up in hoods, that we're really going to stand for that? That moment hasn't passed?
Lord, I hope not.
I'd be hard-pressed to think that would go anywhere.
I guess I get it. I get where we are in this country with not wearing the hoods and stuff like that. I just have a hard time believing people walking down the street in hoods anymore is going to fly.
Well, and how powerful...
I thought a lot of things before January of this year.
November 8th, if you want to be specific.
Yes.
If you think about, though, the flip to this, the flip side is the leadership that we've seen in community to stand up to some of these bold acts. And the other powerful visual from the Charlottesville tragedy was the number of clergy leaders mm-hmm. locked in elbow to elbow or arm to arm, maybe is a better way of saying that, from all across of different denominations and forming that human barricade to protect others. We also know that based on what people were writing that the movement for Black Lives, the leaders there, as well as the Black Lives Movement leaders locally, played a critical role in keeping people safe.
Yes.
It was really interesting, though, if we talk about other juxtapositions that day and how they were handled by law enforcement. When we think about the militarized presence of law enforcement at Ferguson, with literally tanks and the armored gear and the shields and the vest.
Yeah.
And then you look at how police showed up in Charlottesville without that. But yet many of the Charlottesville nationalists, white nationalists, had arms on them. Yeah. I mean, they had arms openly carrying them. And how different it is. And that, again, goes to the points that we've made as a group in the past.
So why is it that we are saying racism is not good? You know, why is it that we're saying that, but that's not true in this country?
Well, you know, in response to what you just said, Luz, my Facebook read and other social media since Charlottesville has shown me hope, because many folks who are posting are white. And they now are, you know, you see this slow growth, right? But which, for some reason with Charlottesville, the lack of police presence, even they were making
those observations.
About how differently Black Lives Matter is treated, how differently the police show up at Ferguson. Even they were pointing out, so even they are beginning to see those differences. And many of them now are realizing that the right has been able to demonize Black Lives Matter and try to equate it to a hate group, which is the furthest thing from...
Well, and a similar... I'm glad you made that point, because a similar point that I'd like to make, an analogy that happened during the civil rights movement, is the demonization of the Black Panthers.
Exactly.
Who we know that the Black Panthers were the group that started a lot of the programs that we have today in terms of
school lunches
and preschool teaching for free.
Community health care.
I mean, the list goes on.
Exactly.
And how they were demonized not only by the media, but by the FBI, by law enforcement. And it's not until you read about Bobby Seale or the books that were written by him that you really understand who the Black Panthers were and what really they stood for. And a lot of those programs are still around today because they're valuable programs, but they were brought to the community at no cost.
We're thinking of, like, if you would read about this, or if you would do this, or if you look at your Facebook, but we all know, like, the majority of people, our Facebook friends, are people who think the same way that we do, right? And these books and learning about the Black Panthers, that's something you have to initialize yourself. And these are things that I think that white nationalists aren't going to go out and read a bunch of books on history, on Black American history.
Although there have been a number of white nationalists who have converted, quote unquote, from their white supremacy ideology over to condemning them. So again, my eternal optimism comes up. There is proof. I don't know in terms of numbers how many will cross over, but it is possible. I had sent an email organization-wide to my group on Friday with the list of things that people can do in terms of being able to move through this continuum of learning. And this underscores Don's point, where there are now certain members of our community who are having these aha moments. We may have seen them along the line, and they're coming on board. I've often said that the issue of race equity is a continuum of learning. And people are on various aspects and parts of that continuum. Mm-hmm. And it's unending, because each of us, as I'm looking around the room, nodding their head, we all continue to learn. It's not a one and done. There's a list of great books on the New York Times that put together in terms of learning the history of race and racism in the U.S., and it really goes down a list to the 1800s to the present day.
So, Luz, I'm going to ask you to read this list that you have in front of you of things that people can do. So our listeners on Minnesota Public Radio can write these down.
And we can post it on our Facebook page.
And we can post it on our Facebook page. And it's going to be things you can do more than just posting on Facebook.
And we're going to post this on Facebook.
Right. But posting on Facebook that I think this is wrong, this another step past that for people who are having their aha moments or people who are wondering what they can do.
Yeah. Thanks, Hilly. And I'll start by saying for some members of our community, going and attending vigils and demonstrations works for them. And others, it doesn't work for them for a variety of reasons. And some, it might be a both and. You might go to a vigil and you might do some of this. So I would start by starting to read some of the books that are on this list. And it really runs a gamut of a number of authors. And I think it's like 24 different books. So we'll post that on. It also is about, at YWCA Minneapolis, we train people to become racial justice facilitators. And that's at no cost. We have a wait list right now. There's a sudden demand to be a racial justice facilitator. But we will train you and leverage then your talent and time in the community to help with that. I'll make one more plug and then I'll move on from there. It's Time to Talk is our 15th anniversary this year. We'll be talking about It's a Good Time for the Truth. All local authors writing about their experiences racially in Minnesota. So you'll get to interact with them and be a part of that. And that's in middle of October. And then beyond that, following and becoming allies to different groups locally and nationally. I think about the NAACP National. I know I get quite a bit of valuable information from them. We have local chapters, Minneapolis. We have St. Paul. We also have Fair Immigration, which talks about immigrant rights and public policy changes around that. That's a national group. Showing Up for Racial Justice, we've talked about that before. It's a national organization with local chapters, and mostly it is for non-people of color. So it is for white people to be a part of Showing Up for Racial Justice, and it teaches you how to be an ally in ways that you can do that, and hosting dinner conversations or coffee conversations about these areas. The ACLU nationally and also ACLU Minnesota is a great resource for things that you can do along those lines. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a phenomenal website. They have a guide. It's 10 Ways to Fight Hate. And it's a really nice guide, 1 through 10. And it gets more sophisticated as you go along that guide. One of the points there that it ends with is really digging deeper within yourself and challenging yourself and asking yourself some simple questions like, who is within your network? Who do you hang out with? Who do you go out to dinner with? Who have you invited into your home? Do they look like you? Do they have similar lived experiences or beliefs? And being able then to start increasing your network that would be reflective of community and not having them as others and really having them as part of who you are as an individual. My caveat there is always is when you're making new friends, don't treat them as oddities or novelties. Mm-hmm. Really look for the humanity and treat them with the humanity that you would want to be treated of yourself. I recently had lunch with an executive in the community, a woman, and halfway in the conversation, she said, you know, I need someone like you in my life. I need a friend. Would you be my mentor? And that was a really nice way of her letting me know that she doesn't have someone with my cultural background in her life and wanted to be able to spend more time. It was very authentic, and I just thought that was a really neat way to go, and I know I'll be spending time with her and having meals with her in the near future. And I'm sure you have more ways as well.
I would throw out Green Card Voices. It is a local movement, and if you're not comfortable going out to do things or meeting other people right now and you want to do your own research, whatever, I would say they have books that have firsthand stories from immigrants. And that's a great way just to kind of familiarize yourself with what's going on locally. Don?
No, I think because you named some really good resources. My comment was, I was just, the whole atmosphere that the country's in right now. In one of our previous podcasts, we talked about the Browning of America, like 2040, 2045.
2042.
So precise. So 2042, you know, the Browning of America, there will be more people of color in the United States than there are our white neighbors, although they'll still be the largest group. I think one of the things we were addressing was what that kind of meant for us as people of color. And I remember making the comment, well, as a Native American, I didn't think things would change that much. Because sometimes we don't have that conversations in amongst ourselves in terms of Native American, Asian, African American, and Latino. And Latino, Hispanic, you know, we do such a disservice and clump such a large category of individuals in that thing. Otherwise, you know, it helps explain why we can end up with a Rubio and others, you know, from that community. But what we didn't talk about at that time, when I was the reaction of white America to the Browning of this country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think this presidency is a result of that fear from many of our, not the majority, but many of our white neighbors, that fear is what drove this individual to his presidency. What do you think about that?
Well, so yes, and... I would say it's a culmination of other actions and initiatives that have been ramping up to that. So I would say the voter ID movement, the gerrymandering movement, the disinvestment in health and human services type of funding, the overcriminalization and overpolicing in Black communities. The prison, the private prison complex, the list goes on and on, right?
Yes.
So there have been systemic actions that have been taking place that I would say have culminated to this, right?
Yes.
So we're seeing the physical manifestation of that, but systemically, those measures have been encroaching on the proliferation of our population.
Well, well, the future of work, the future of jobs, which is a prominent issue in every community, no matter what your race, though that also comes up in the conversations about why someone joins a white nationalist or a white supremacist group, is they're looking for community, and then the conversations often go to, well, we just need Middle America to have gainful employment again, and...
See, I think that's a dog whistle, though. That's a dog whistle in my mind, because when you look at the unemployment rate in white communities versus Black communities, it is still a fraction of the unemployment rate in Black communities. I also think about the fact that what we're really talking about is a radicalization of white people, some white people within the white nationalist, that is very similar to the terroristic type of nationalization and labeling that we have of Muslims, that we, the fear of terrorists completely just overwhelm us in the psyche and has been drilled into us by the media and by the president. But they want to frame it as only being Muslims when in the U.S. it's been quite the opposite. It's
white
been
the terrorism.
The terrorism and terrorist attacks, you know, the majority of the attacks in the U.S. have been by non-Muslims and mostly by white men. And more in the last week, there have been experts that have spoken about the similarity in the radicalization of these two groups, and that really the heads up for us should be that there is this radicalization of white men here along these lines, and it's not based on the economy or the fear of not having the jobs. It's based on Don's point earlier, the Browning of America.
I think let's not forget also that there are as many white women at the march in Charlottesville as there are men. And I think that that's something that...
You mean among the white nationals?
Among the white nationals. That's something that we, you know, I think a lot of people would just go, oh, the white guys.
I'm not
guys,
sure it was as
right?
many women, but there were, I think your point but, is that there but, were women
yes.
in the
Oh,
audience.
Yeah.
So it's not just the white men.
Right.
I'm wondering, to your point about trying to make a list of what to do, because I've been very curious as we see one of the reactions to Charlottesville has been a ramping up and acceleration. And frankly, you could argue that the effort to save that Robert E. Lee statue backfired in so many ways because so many other Confederate statues have come down just since then.
And they've come down silently, which I thought was
overnight,
yeah,
you know,
amazing.
In Texas and Baltimore.
Texas, yeah.
I'm wondering about here in Minnesota because I see on the Minnesota grounds of the Capitol the Christopher Columbus statue, which actually has a plaque on it that says Columbus facilitated the merging of cultures between the old world and the new world. And
so I was merged.
You were merged, John.
My ancestors were merged. That's a nice way of putting
it. But you know, right next to Columbus is a statue of Knute Nelson, who was a governor and a senator and a representative. Very long career, very distinguished career in many estimations. But one of the things he did as a U.S. representative in the 5th Congressional District, he was the first ever when the 5th was created, he sponsored the Nelson Act, which was considered the Dawes Act for Minnesota, which forced the relocation of American Indians.
And took our land.
And created the allotments.
Right, exactly.
And you moved to White Earth, you moved to Red yep. Lake, and then the rest of the land is allotted.
Yep.
Do you take down Knute Nelson? And I will actually bring up President Trump's question at this point. Where do you stop?
Mm-hmm. Well, see, and that's
the liberal PC.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And see, so, you know, and as a person of color, and for me, you know, covering both sides, being biracial, Native American and African American, that is the inherent question with our entire white supremacy and the way this country was set up. Because ever since I was in grade school and I was taught that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, the founders of this country, mm-hmm. In my mind, I'm wondering, well, how could that be? Because they owned slaves. So Trump is not, you know, Trump is using it to defuse the situation. Mm-hmm. I, however, as a person of color, I mean, look what this country did to the Sacred Hills and Black Hills for the Sioux. And what could be a greater insult than to take sacred land and then put four white presidents up there that were all instrumental in taking this country from them.
So let me ask, do you take down Columbus on the Minnesota?
Well, so here,
do you take down Knute Nelson? Do you change the
flag? I'm going to counter back with another question. Okay. That's not my question, sure. But it came up on social media, which I thought was really poignant. If someone kidnapped your child and sold them, where would you want us to put the statue of that person?
Thank you. Where would you want us
that's
to put
really
that
at,
statue?
At, so if you strip down the notoriety slash celebrity-ish slash type of standing, if you will, of a name and everything that goes with it, we got to unlearn that and unpack that and get to the issue at hand is the atrocities that were committed by that individual. And that's really what we're going
to. I used to live in St. Louis, and St. Louis renamed Highway 70 after Mark McGwire, okay, after he hit 70 home runs. Guess what happened a few years later?
Right.
He admitted to steroids, right? I mean, naming things and creating statues can be fraught no matter what.
And it's not rewriting history. I'm sorry, but taking down a statue does not mean that person never existed.
Exactly.
So that argument that you're rewriting history, you're taking away our heritage, is just it's not an argument. It doesn't make any sense.
Their heritage of hate never goes away. It's just we don't have to look at the emblem
right,
anymore
exactly.
or the symbol for it.
He's still in the history books for what he did. He just don't have a stance to honoring
him. So for me, the question that Tom brings up, I think, is one that a lot of people are struggling with because we have, you know, for me, in previous conversations as a Native American, there are many things in Minnesota that remind
mm-hmm.
me
yes.
You know, I mean, we're right here in Ramsey County, mm-hmm. and Alexander Ramsey was one of the main causes of the Sioux Uprising and the displacement of the Dakota people in Minnesota. I'm reminded day in and day out just by the streets, the counties, and other figures that Minnesota recognizes as their whatever were, you know, some of them were pretty low down individuals mm-hmm. in how they treated Native Americans, mm-hmm. African Americans, and everyone else. So this country is built on that. And that's, we have always said this country is built on white supremacy. I think many white Americans are finally beginning to understand
right.
what that means. Because we've been saying it our entire lives, and we've been poo-pooed and we've been dismissed. Mm-hmm. Charlottesville, I think, helped many white Americans come to the realization, because, as I said earlier, in this whole discussion, these white nationalists, Trump and some of them, they're going to redefine who's white.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And right now, Jews are being eliminated from that description, but who's next? Right?
Yeah. I think about a quote when we're in the middle of discussion, and also, you know, getting to where we really started with this discussion, and it's a quote by Frederick Douglass. I know of no rights of race superior to the rights of humanity.
Mm.
If you think about that, I mean, that really is what should ground us the entire time, is the rights of humanity and the assertion by some that the rights of humanity of some are less than or non-existent than others. And we know that human rights are a right. You don't have to qualify for it. You know, you don't have to work towards it. You don't have to earn it. By the very virtue of being born as a human, it is a right. So you don't have to work towards it or define it or earn it. It really is something that should be honored because you are a human. And at the very crux of what we're talking about in terms of the Browning of America and the hate acts and the violence that have been occurring, it's continuing to want to dehumanize individuals of certain backgrounds, whether it's people of color, indigenous people, Jewish individuals, members of the GLBTQI community. It's all that. It's the underlying, I think, thread that runs through all of that.
I love you, Luz. You know, I don't know where it ends. I don't know how far it goes. I don't know if we start changing Ramsey County and we start, you know, taking down George Washington. I don't know. All I know is that I hope that people will be respectful of each other while all this happens, and that we all support each other, right? Because our allies, our white allies, are there for us, and we need them. And I'm glad that they're there, and I'm glad people are having their aha moments, and hope that nothing like Charlottesville happens again. This is Counter Stories. I'm Lili.
Don Eubanks.
Luz Maria Frias.
And Tom Weber.